Before we get to today's podcast, I want to remind you about another great ESPN podcast, the Woj Pod. Every week, Woj chats with the newsmakers in and around the NBA, players, coaches, executives, and more. This week, he's at the All-Star Game in Chicago doing a live event with Jackie McMullen, Bobby Marks, and others, so be sure to check that one out. Download and subscribe to the Woj Pod and the right time wherever you get your podcast. Let's talk about Daniel. A year ago, he resolved to stop putting off what he wanted to do, get into information technology. Daniel enrolled in My Computer Career and is already a few months into his IT career. Make 2020 your year. There are millions of unfilled cybersecurity positions in the U.S. right now, and My Computer Career is training people to help fill them. No IT experience or education? No problem. It's not rocket science. It's My Computer Career. Go to mycomputercareer.edu and take the free career evaluation today. You can start your new life as an IT pro in months, not years. Attend classes on campus or live online just twice a week to get what you'll need to start your new career. More than just a school, My Computer Career helps you get into the industry by working with hundreds of employers that hire our students. My Computer Career is nationally accredited and financial aid is available for those who qualify, including the GI Bill. Classes start soon, so make new year, new career your resolution and take the free career evaluation today at mycomputercareer.edu. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to think you are a hater. This is the time of week where we do interviews. And I was talking to a buddy of mine about the Michael Vick documentary and just the different thoughts that we had. And so I thought it'd make a pretty good podcast. So joining us now, he is the author of 4 books. The most recent is called The Water Dancer. Be sure to check that out. His name is Ta-Nehisi Coates. What's going on, man?
Hey, how you doing, Bo? Good to talk to you, man.
Dude, man, great to have you. And I've been actually waiting for the right time in the last 2 years to get you on, but the Vick documentary was one that really got me, right? Because part of it, we've also been talking this year about Lamar Jackson and a lot of stuff with you being from Baltimore, so I just thought it tied together with so many different things. And I guess the first thought was, like, what was Michael Vick to you? Like, as it was going on, did you see him as something beyond just being an entertaining football player? Because one thing the documentary really did was look at him as almost like a paradigm change.
Yeah, you know, there's a moment in that doc that I think about, actually, to answer your question, where he's actually with the Eagles, is sort of the latter part. And he comes out, and the Eagles have, like, sort of a throwback joint on, and he's wearing number 7. And I was watching with my wife, and I got emotional because I said, oh, for a moment, like, he looked like Randall. And so, like, I like, the first person really, like, I thought Vick was incredible, and this is, you know, no takeaway, but, you know, like, I thought about Randall having that cannon of an arm. I mean, Randall threw a 95-yard touchdown. You know, I joined the Fred Barton. I thought about Randall and how he would run around, all those incredible plays. And you know, what I think about is, like, where the league was when Randall was in, where it was with Vick and where it is now. And I have to say, like, you wonder if it had been where it is now, like, for Vick and for Randall, you know what I'm saying, whether things would have been different. And you can see that, you know, the difference in progress. I think Vick got to do some things Randall didn't quite get to do, and became an icon in a way Randall didn't really. And then you watch a dude like Mahomes, I mean, you know, just incredible, Deshaun, or any of these guys, Lamar, any of these dudes, man.
Yeah, because, like, the black quarterback thing is interesting for me because I grew up in Houston. So, like, we get to Houston in 87, we got Warren Moon. I saw a black quarterback playing every week. Like, somehow, I don't think I fully understood, like, what the deal was, but I knew with Randall when he was out, I was like, okay, beyond, like, the fact that he's black, is this dude is running. Like, this is a whole different, like, level of excitement that comes here. And I don't think I was able at the time, just because of limited experience, to, like, really do the math and understand, like, what was going on with any of these guys and what they were overcoming in order to get to the place where they were. Now, I understood it when they ran Warren out of town for Cody Carlson. All of a sudden, everything was, like, crystal clear. It made sense at that point, right? But, like, Randall was that dude. But I find it interesting because I don't remember people thinking of Randall quite as a pioneering kind of figure in the way that with Vick, it really jumped off the screen. Just like, oh, whoa, wait a minute.
They
we ain't never seen nothing like
they
this.
And I feel like they might not have even referenced him in that doc, I don't think.
Not really.
I don't think Randall came up. I could be way, way wrong, and it sounds a little too surprising to say that. But I kept waiting. I mean, and that's no disrespect, you know, to the doc. I mean, one of the things that you know, I didn't understand was like Tony Dungy. You know, the fact that Tony Dungy, you know, so they, you know, had played a played the quarterback position and had, you know, contemporary Warren Moon. And so, like, I get that they were probably trying to provide a, you know, a more historical perspective and everything. But, you know, I knew Randall was doing something different. I mean, let's be straight. He didn't run, what did Vic run, a 4.240? He wasn't as fast as Vic.
Right.
I mean, he just wasn't. You know, I know that. So I'm not even trying to say they was the same dude. You know, Vic was just extraordinary, man. I mean, Vic was—he was just absolutely, absolutely extraordinary because he had that cannon, you know, arm. When he wanted to, he could be so accurate, and just the sheer speed. I mean, I think it's you who says very early in the doc, what would this cat have been if from jump he had said, you know, I'm about football, and it's scary. It's scary. I had forgotten how good he was when he came back to the Eagles too. I had forgotten he was actually that good. You know what I mean? Which is pretty. Now he wasn't as good as he'd been. You know what I mean? But it was a decent second career. You know what I mean?
Right. And like I think, like, because I had that thought about Vic, because part of the disappointment, and it was an interesting thing in watching that doc, where like the Tony Dungy example for me, where they're like, hey, Tony Dungy was a quarterback, and then they made him play defensive back. Well, to be fair, Tony Dungy was 6 foot, 180 pounds, right? Like,
right.
I don't know. I don't know exactly what quarterback it was that he was going to be. And then he wound up being a different pioneer because he was a defensive coordinator at age 26,
right?
With the Pittsburgh Steelers. Like, that was a big one. With Moon, I always remember like hearing about how Warren Moon went undrafted, and I had just had this thought, well, okay, well, maybe there was this thing or whatever. And then you go back and look at those clips of him in college, and you're like, dog, what the hell was anybody talking about here? Like, was the racism that powerful?
Do you remember that game against Kansas City where he threw for like 500 yards?
Yep.
Kansas City was like the number one ranked. I know they plan to run and shoot, but Kansas City, if I'm recalling this correct, was like the number one defense that year. And he went out there, and I had never seen anything like that. So even for me, and I guess, you know, not being in Houston, it was clear to me that this dude is on a, you know, just really, really on another level. And it's only one of them. You know, it's really only one of them, you know, out there right now.
Yo, I had to be, it wasn't until I was an adult that I realized that Warren Moon mattered to anybody else.
No, I love Warren Moon. He mattered. I mean, he mattered. Any black quarterback that was at that level mattered a lot to me.
Yeah.
Mattered a lot. I mean, I remember my dad, you know, for instance, you know, when the Redskins go to the Super Bowl with Doug Williams, you know, and Jay Schrader gets hurt, and Doug Williams comes back in. And my dad was so ecstatic. Like, it was like, you know what I mean? He wasn't the biggest sports dude, but he was ecstatic, you know what I mean? Watching Doug Williams do his thing, you know, throwing to Ricky Sanders and, you know, Timmy Smith. I mean, he was just off the charts excited, man.
Yo, that Doug Williams thing is so hard to explain to people. Like, I talked about it. I said, look, I don't fully remember. I remember Doug winning that Super Bowl, but I don't really remember what it was like at work and stuff the day after, right? But I remember what it was like when Obama got elected. And I imagine that when Doug Williams won that Super Bowl, it had to be, I mean, it had to be, because, you know, I got a Louisiana family. So Doug was a whole different level for them in that. And then Doug won that Super Bowl. Oh, boy. I wish I would have been more, like, contemporary to the time.
Oh, man, coming out of Grambling to see, a brother coming out of HBCU to do that. Crazy.
And Doug was like I would say, if there like a couple of moments from the 80s that speak to like this is what life is like being a black quarterback. One, Doug Williams got the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. He was the quarterback when they went to the NFC Championship game.
Yep.
And then they offered him a contract that was worse than the contracts of half the backups in the NFL. And then in the early 90s, Warren Moon had a clause in his contract that said, if I am one of the top three quarterbacks in passer rating at the end of the year, my contract gets bumped up to the average of the top three quarterbacks in the NFL. And he did that. And Bud Adams, the owner, was like, that's nice. We're not going to pay you.
Are you serious? That happened?
That happened.
Did he sue?
I think he did. But they told him it was like $1 million or something like that. And it's like, nah, no thanks. This right, like this was like the condition of the black quarterback coming up. And so then you do have Randall Cunningham, and of course cats were killing it in college, you know, when all that stuff came around. And then Donovan McNabb comes, and like him being booed will always stick with me in that the greatest quarterback in the history of the franchise. I guess you didn't know it at the time, but then they still talk crazy about him.
Right. I was left with so many conflicting emotions watching that, man. Like, on the one level, I was really, really happy that Vic turned out the way Vic turned out. You know what I mean? He actually was, you know, able to get settled. Listen, prison destroys people, man. Prison destroys people. I know, you know, you hear people say, well, it gave me time to think, and I put my, you know, life together. And I'm sure that happens. But you put that, you know, next to what prison, you know, actually does to most people, I mean, it just so to see him, you know, turn out okay, you know what I mean, the way he did, you know, it just left me feeling really, really warm. But at the same time, you know, being in this moment right now, with black quarterbacks being so prominent, and also being in this moment where CTE and head trauma is so well known, it's like, why these two things got to happen at the same time?
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's like this man, I got to tell you what, Mike, it is the shadow over everything. Like anytime, you know, I'm watching a game or cheering, I was just looking at this joint of Deshaun Watson on that show at a boardroom. Deshaun's so impressive. Just an impressive dude. You know what I mean? And you just think about like how much, you know, head trauma is just hanging over, you know, CT is hanging over this stuff, man.
Like I was thinking about, you know, Steve Atwater's going into the Hall of Fame. And,
yes.
And I was like, are they going to be able to play the Steve Atwater highlight reel at the Hall of Fame? Because we don't do that anymore, right? Like, I think about the hits that we used to look at and be like, yeah. Now it happens. Yeah. And we're like, ooh.
Yeah. And not only that, that's why Steve Atwater got in the Hall of Fame.
Yes.
He's not incidental. You know what I mean? That's who Steve Atwater was. He did that thing. That specific thing that he did.
Right. Like, what is your primary skill? You don't want these problems.
Right, exactly.
Right in front, right over here is a world of problems. I deliver.
That's what I do. Yep. That's why I'm in the Hall of Fame.
And I'm wondering, like, when his speech comes up, he's got to make mention to the fact that, like, yo, man, there'll never be another guy like me in the Hall of Fame because they don't let you do this.
They don't let you do this anymore. They don't let you do this anymore. Nah, it's crazy. It's really, really crazy. And I was a huge Steve Atwater fan. Him and Dennis Smith, man.
Yep.
You know, and that's what they did. That's what they did, you know. It's really, really interesting. But I enjoyed it, man. I was I saved it, you know. I taped one and didn't watch it until the second one came on because I didn't want to have to wait. I knew it was going to be, you know, Stanley Nelson is like, he's the LeBron of this right now,
right.
You know, in terms of these docs. So I knew what it was going to be, but it struck me in so many ways. You know, him, and I've, you know, thought about this a long time, but I thought him discussing the dynamics of why you bring your people with you was probably the most powerful and the most clarifying for, you know, folks who are not, you know, who are outside of the experience to see. But, you know, like for somebody to say you're at this point and now everybody you was around, they can't come, or most of them, maybe not everybody, your mama can come, your wife can come.
Right.
But these people can't come with you. And you got to be around this new group of people and this new, and let's be clear, in terms of what the NFL is, this new group of people are trying to take from you. They're not, you know, people that are going to be on your side no matter what happens. You know, and so, like, just the loneliness, man, I mean, must be incredible, you know?
Yo, and it's funny you mentioned that because, like, you and I have a similar thing now. You know, you a genius now. You know, your life changes a little bit. You get a little more behind you. But that happened to us in our 30s, right? And so, like, the people around us were kind of formed, and they were in their lives and probably settled in what it was that they were going, you know, what they were going to do. Like, I always say the greatest luxury I've had is hardly anybody's ever asked me for money. People have, but it's not like this long line of people who now expect me to take care of them. I can't imagine being 21 years old and you looking back at everybody, and you used to not having nothing. So the idea of, like, using all of it to bring somebody with you, you don't think you need extra money. Extra money is not a concept.
Right.
You know,
it's not a concept. And I mean, not only did it, you know, does it happen to you at that age? They're looking at him in high school like, oh, it's going to happen.
Yeah,
it's going to happen. He's going to be that dude. You know what I mean? He, you know, takes his boy with him to college and everything. And I get it, man. They were talking to the brother who's the financial advisor, and the brother said, "Well, Mike said to me, if I'm eating steak, you know, I want everybody around me to eat steak." And I was, you know, literally talking to a buddy about that, you know, and he was laughing. And I said, you know, this is horrid, but I get it. Like, it's actually, you know, like, what kind of wants to sit around and eat steak? Why else doesn't? Who wants to eat steak alone? You have to be a psychopath.
What y'all getting? Right?
You know, no, I'm ahead of seven. You got to be a certain kind of person. Now, maybe you won't end up in the situation Vic ended up in. But, I mean, maybe you're going to be unhealthy in a lot of other ways.
Yeah, like I saw a story once he told about the first time he went out with Arthur Blank to some steakhouse and he ordered chicken fingers because he just didn't know any better, right? It was like he looked on the menu and that was the thing that he recognized was chicken fingers because he never heard of filet mignon. And so he gets chicken fingers, right? You can't then be like, oh, no, he'll take what I used to take. He'll take my old usual.
You had a chicken finger.
Yeah, I'll take my new usual.
Right, right, like the usual. Exactly, exactly. And I think, like, that's a thing that, you know, we've seen play out with athletes and entertainers over the years, man. And I have to tell you, the thing it makes me wonder about is not, like, the Michael Vicks. That's not what I wonder about. I wonder about the LeBrons. I wonder about the Kevin Garnetts. I wonder about the ones, you know, I don't know everybody's private life, but I wonder about the ones who come in that young, come from a similar environment, and yet are okay.
Yeah.
You know, or seem to be, you know, at least from what I can tell, seem to be relatively okay. I wonder how that happens. You know what I mean? Like, the Vic thing actually isn't that surprising. You know, the dog fighting aspect of it. I was surprised some of the folks turned on him. I was surprised about his cousin giving him up that quick.
Yeah.
You know, that was a little surprising. I get how one ends up in that situation. I very much get out, and I actually find that a little bit more comprehensible than how one doesn't end up in that situation, you know?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You mentioned, you know, the idea of his buddy coming with him to college. You know, we both went to HBCUs, and one thing the HBCU has is the dude that's just around. Right?
Oh, all the time.
Right? You don't know why exactly he's there. He's cool with somebody, right? And he's around. And then I got to Carolina for grad school, and I didn't realize, especially with the athletes and football players, that dude is on that yard, too, just around. Like, oh, you got somebody paying for you to stay there? Oh, okay, cool.
Wow.
I'm here. And so Vic brought his boy, Quanis, and the thing that struck me about Quanis in that documentary, did you notice how many times he said we about Michael Vick's money?
Oh, man. Yes, I did.
Like,
yes,
we going yes, back to a regular life. What's we?
Yes, I did. And the thing was, like, I didn't realize that they had had a break until relatively late in the documentary.
Mm-hmm.
It's only after they had that party, which was insane. It's only after they had that party, Quanis and, you know, him actually say, yo, we ain't spoke in years,
yeah.
You know? I think, like, I also wondered, and this is kind of hinted at all through, like, how much of this was, like, his wife. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, you are very, very lucky if you meet somebody and you are, you sign a $100 million contract, lose everything, go to jail, come back out with, what'd they say, they had negative $2,000 in the account?
Yep.
And that person is still with you. That is a different, you know, sort of thing. That's somebody that actually cares about you. And so I wondered if, you know, how much of that was like, yo, you got a chance. I mean, she said it. Seems like he can't be around.
Yeah.
She said it.
Yo, you know, I mean, this sounds terrible to say, but you know how mad I'd be at that dude for showing up at my party and getting shot? All right, like, I know he didn't want to get shot. Nobody wants to get shot. But, like, yo, man, I'm just getting back. I probably shouldn't be having this party in the first place.
Yeah, why are you here? Why are you here?
He's like, yo, we back. Yeah. We back. Like, that was the – it just struck me. And the level tone he'd always have when he talked about it is like, who?
Yeah.
We going to Atlanta. What? What?
Yeah. Yeah. But he said he'd do it again. He said he'd do it again. I mean, they asked him. He said, I wouldn't do nothing. You know, and that was one of the cold parts, like, in the first part where he says, you know, we was dog lovers. That's how we thought about it.
Right. We'll be back to talk more with Ta-Nehisi Coates. But first, tired of that 230 feeling? You're not alone. In fact, research shows that more than 70% of us hit the wall after lunch. Let a 5-hour energy shot help you leap over that wall instead of crashing into it. Anyone who travels frequently knows how tiring it can be. Whether you're on business or on vacation, 5-hour energy shot can help you stay alert and energized wherever you may be headed. 5-hour energy helps you get through your crazy on-the-go life. With zero sugar, 4 calories, and a convenient portable size, it's the perfect pick-me-up for busy, hard-working people. Now it comes in 2 extra-strength tropical tastes. Strawberry banana and tropical burst. They're great. They are delicious and can take you to a tropical on-the-go experience. Try them both, then go online to shop5hourenergy.com and use the code BOMANI to receive a one-time offer of 10% off your order. That's shop5hourenergy.com. Use the code BOMANI. Go to shop5hourenergy.com and use the code BOMANI to receive a one-time offer of 10%. 5-Hour Energy. Energy on the go.
Bo, I got to be real with you. Like, part of it was it put some other ethical conversations. Like, the one Quanis does, and I, you know, I was texting about this, one Quanis does, he says, well, what about horse racing? You know what I mean? Which is a brutal sport. It's a brutal sport. You know what I mean? But the thing I think about is, why is this different than factory farming? Like, it's not really clear to me. You know what I mean? I don't just mean straight up, you know, meat, you know, consumption. But given what happens in factories, And it don't have to happen that way. Like, it's not like it's a thing. Like, so I went through, okay, well, with dog fighting as an element of torture, you know what I mean, for pleasure. So that's wrong. Well, in fact, the farming, in fact, it actually is an element of torturing for pleasure. You know what I mean? So you can have that Popeye sandwich, so you can have that, you know, that nothing against the Popeye sandwich
right.
specifically, not trying to call that out. But in general, society tolerate. It's fine. It's fine. And so, like, the other thing that came down to me was just, like, how much of this is about power? Like, how much of this is about what kind of cruelties you embrace and what kind that you don't, you know?
Yeah, and it's the affection for dogs, right? And, like, the affection that people have for dogs, and I think the roles that, like, dogs play in people's lives, and they see them as their gentle protectors and all of these things. Like, this is the one. Like, if they had been out there fighting roosters, which is a thing in other places, we're probably not having this discussion. Like, I think anybody would have to be honest that what we're talking about here is not strictly a matter of principle. That's why some of the things that people say after the fact get me about Vic. Like, so for one, and you know, what he did was dead ass wrong, and there's no way around that, right? But I hear people say the thing, well, you know, people who torture animals, they, you know, how many of them eventually become serial killers? And I'm like, well, show me the trail of bodies, right? Like that's like the people saying marijuana is a gateway drug. Well, show me Willie Nelson on heroin. Like, by now, this would have manifested itself as it came up, but I did not know. And I tell people this, I had no idea that people had these attitudes about dogs and dog fighting until this happened.
I gotta say, I mean, look, dog fighting is not something I would have done, but like when he's talking about, like, you know, like dogs outside and all of that, like I remember that. We had stray dogs around the neighborhood. Like, I remember that. You know what I mean? Like, that was a not too foreign thing. I wouldn't have been into it because I'm not, you know, into that sort of thing, but the notion that, like, it would never occur to me that you go to jail like that, for instance. Mm-mm. Like, that just, that never would have, that was not something I would have been aware of. And I gotta say, while on one level it do gotta deal with the affection people have for dogs, I mean, you gotta say it also has to deal with how people feel about, you know, black men and how they felt about that particular black man. You talking about this dude is executed?
Yo.
I mean, even at one point, the PETA dude says, listen, let's be real. If this was Peyton Manning, it wouldn't have went like this. We know that.
Yeah. And you know, and I wonder if PETA, because PETA's stuff with race is always weird because they do so much stuff to, like, they compare the struggle of marginalized people in this country to the struggle of animals in a way that black
people
have
a rooster kneeling or something recently?
Oh, it was all the animals. They had a salmon kneel. A fish. Right, with the national anthem playing. And it's just like, yo, man, what are you doing right now? Like, how does this go? And I made this point on a different podcast where I was like, a lot of black people believe that the animal rights movement sees these animals as being more valuable than black people are. And they bristle at it and they resist it. And I totally get it. But when then you saw those clips of those people being like, yo, Michael Vick needs to be hung. And it was like, whoa, don't you think we're skipping some steps, buddy?
Wow. Yeah. So, I don't know. I mean, I left just really impressed with him because I just think to go through that, and I'm going to be real about this, the shadow over that doc for me also was like watching Allen Iverson.
Yes.
And watching the contrast and all that Iverson, you know, who I loved, man. I mean, Iverson went to Georgetown, you know, was at Howard at the time. Then, you know, goes to the Sixers, and, you know, I actually was living in Delaware, not too far from there, so just huge Allen Iverson fan, and like how it feels like he, to this very day, doesn't quite understand, you know, like he's almost in like conscious rebellion
right.
against something, because even the demeanor was just different. You could just tell, you know what I mean? It's not like, you know, somebody's asking you to reject where you come from. I mean, Mike say very early in there, listen, if you don't love where you're from, you're going to be an unhappy person. I thought that was like one of the realest
things profound.
To say. Profound, actually, profound. But it's one thing to love where you come from, and it's another thing to say, I'm forever here. I will always be here. This is all I'm about, and this is all I am. You know, it was just it's a difference, and you can see it, you know?
Yeah, like Vic seems happy now. And it's interesting because when I go back and look at that stuff from while he was playing for the Falcons, I'm actually not sure how happy he actually was, right? Like, you never hear any clips of him smiling or anything like that. Allen Iverson, I've read enough and talked to enough people to know that this is a man who has never been happy. And to be honest, if I had been dealt the hand that he had been dealt, like, I never had to go down the street to buy dope for my mama, right? And then never had that same mama believe truly that God sent me
to this planet in order to get her out of poverty. And so he gets her out. He gets everybody out. Hey, man, I've seen Iverson around. Like, I saw him at the All-Star game a couple years ago. Ain't none of them dudes still there, right? And I don't know why exactly all them dudes, you know, those dudes are not there anymore. But all these people, these day ones, you don't see much of them around Iverson anymore. Like, it seems like the existence for him is just kind of lonely to the point where he, you know what he strikes me as? You know those people that you have a conversation with and you try your damnedest to avoid asking, so what you been up to? Right? Like, I don't, what would the answer be if you asked Allen Iverson what he's been up to?
Yeah, probably nothing good.
Probably nothing good.
And, you know, I got to tell you, you just kind of hinted at it and what you just said. Like, so the shadow over all of this that you can't stop thinking about, you know, what, you know, why is your boy coming with you to college? Why when I went to Howard, you know, when both of us went off to school, why was it the case that there were always people there who didn't go there? And the fact of the matter is, what is back home? Like, what is going to happen to you back home? You know what I mean? And you know that. And so you feel like, I mean, again, this is very human for me. Like, it's very, very human. You feel like, okay, I got an opportunity to, you know, make something out of myself and do X, Y, and Z. And while I do that, I'm thinking about you, you know, left in this situation. You know, no jobs, no, you know what I mean, unsafe area, you know, guns, drugs, et cetera. You know, poverty. You know, it seems very human if that's your boy or that's your people to say, nah, you come with me. You're safer here. You are.
Right.
You are.
And who am I supposed to hang out with here, right? Because I think that if you, especially for athletes, right, who are not going to college on some academic track that has probably taken them and put them around some more, you know, different types of people, whatever, they get in there and they just kind of like, yo, like Vic talked about going to Blacksburg, Virginia after being in Newport News, which is like the super culture shock, right? He's talking about he's getting out there and, you know, Nelson did a good job of that, like showing a picture of like the white folks on the quad and what they were doing. It is like, yo, if I'm Michael Vick, like I think we underestimate about college in particular how frightening it is for people, especially if you don't have much of a background or your people didn't do that. And that people, that's why people drink so much in college, right? Like they're afraid when they get there.
Right.
And so you get to bring your partner and then it's like, okay, cool. We gonna be all right. And you're young. You don't really care. Like I remember one of my partners, my roommate in college, he was from like off Stewart Avenue in Atlanta, somewhere over there. And he always had his partners that were coming up on the yard in part because they were just his partners and he was in town. And the other thing was, like you said, what were they doing that was going to be better than this? And then there's always the fun of when the partner that they bring just becomes part of the social structure of your school. And now he's hollering at the girls and everything else. And then he's just walking around with a backpack with no books in it.
Yeah, exactly. Which is what happened.
Yes. Like, oh, yeah, I'm a English major. Oof.
Yeah, which is exactly what happens. You know, the other thing that was interesting about the doc is I could be wrong about this, and I certainly don't, you know, want to, like, I mean, it's an incredible, incredible doc, but I felt like I was watching it and I could see the shadow of the O.J. doc.
Yeah.
Ezra's joint. Like, I felt like I could really feel it. I mean, in a good way. You know what I mean? Like, I don't, you know, I'm not, you know, trying to say somebody's biting or anything, but it was just amazing to me, like, how it felt like it shaped its pacing, its tone, you know, and everything. Maybe Stanley was on that before Ezra. Maybe Ezra got it for Stanley. I don't know. But that was one of the things that got me, too.
Yeah.
Maybe that joint is just burrowed in my head, and I just can't forget it, you know?
Yo, because that OJ doc, because I remember, I think, because Ezra had sent me when I went to Paris, Ezra was like, yo, can you make sure that Coach gets a look at the doc? I was like, cool.
You brought me the DVD, didn't you?
Yep, I brought you the DVD.
And I think either you gave me the first episode or I couldn't find the other episodes, and I watched that DVD, and I was like, I have to see the rest of this.
Yes.
And I couldn't see it like another week or something. And you know, it was wild. Ezra was trying to show it to me. And, you know, a buddy of mine, you know, mutual friend of ours, you know, was like, Ezra's doing, or maybe Ezra told me, I'm doing a 6-hour or 7-hour, however long it was, doc. And I said, no sports documentary, no documentary about could actually be that good for that long.
Yeah, and it was nuts. And it was top to bottom. He managed in the 5th episode of that to produce a comedy. And that is maybe the most amazing part of the whole thing, is in the end, it becomes the funniest caper in the history of mankind. Right.
Incredible.
Like, that's the other thing about Vic's story was, Vic's story didn't come with a lot to laugh at, right? Like, it didn't come, it was like, okay, I'm glad this turned around in the end. One thing I thought about this documentary too, and I was curious if you noticed this, there was not, and I wonder how this went over for a lot of people, a lot of what's happened since Vic went to jail has been a centering of the dogs who were involved. Like, people still write stories about the dogs who lived that they found and, you know, where they are. You know, where are they now, basically, on these dogs? And Stan made what I thought was actually a fairly bold choice, which is to say, we are going to make clear that this was improper behavior, but we're not going to focus on the cruelty that is surrounding this because, like, if it was court, you could argue it was prejudicial.
You know, like, this is a terrible thing to say. I never read those stories. I never watch, like, God, this is terrible. I'm not interested in that.
I've read any of them. No shade. I just don't read them.
Like, I'm happy that, you know, it ended up well. Don't get me wrong. But I'm not that dude. I care about Vic. I care about the person. I care about the black man. I'm just being real with you. That's who I care about. That's what I want to know. I want to know what happened. You know what I mean? Like, I don't. Again, I hate to keep going back to this, but it's like, you know, we live in a country where part of our food production, you know, is about, you know, doing, you know, many of the things or competing, you know, committing cruelties is certainly on the level of what they committed. And we're fine with it. It goes past every day, every day, every day. So, I mean, I'm about as interested in that as I am in the turkeys that don't get executed on Thanksgiving. You know what I mean? Like the pardon, the turkey pardon. You know, that's about how interesting it is, you know, those stories are to me.
Yeah, and I thought that the decision to make it a story of redemption was interesting because that was what the focus on was, the redemption of Vic. Because the thing is, he did 2 years in Leavenworth. Like, you talk about prison breaking people. They didn't just send him to, like, any old prison. Leavenworth. They sent him to a prison I've heard of. Right? Like, you ain't never heard of no prison because of how nice it was. Right? You only hear about prisons if they mean. So he gets out of that. And he did everything on the back end that you could possibly ask for somebody to do if there is some atonement that is necessary. Like, he is actually the template for what people want. And then the part that's always made me a little uncomfortable with him is he turned into a forgiveness machine for everybody else. Like, I wish there would have been time to talk about when Riley Cooper got caught saying the N-word at that concert.
That's right.
He got an extra 2 years in the league, I think, only because Michael Vick was on that team and Michael Vick was required to forgive everybody because he felt his whole place was based on forgiveness.
Yeah, it would have been nice. But, you know, the flip of that is, I mean, Vic probably didn't have the social capital at that point to say, kick this dude out.
Oh, no.
About in the world. Because they would have brought up the dogs.
Yep.
Like, at least he didn't execute dogs.
Yo, but I do remember this. Early, he was like, yo, I forgive him, and we going to do this. And then a few days later, Vic was in camp like, yo, man, I've done all I can. Like, these cats ain't trying to hear it. I've said all I have to say.
Is that what he said? That's what he said.
Yeah, it was just like, hey, man, I don't know what to do. I'm trying to bridge the gap. I'm trying to bring these people together. But, like, Cooper stayed. He had a good year that year. And I'll just always remember, like, DeSean Jackson catch a touchdown. Riley Cooper tries to give him a high five. DeSean Jackson, keep on running. Like, I don't even see him. Riley Cooper got an extension, played one more year, has not been seen since. Teams were like, nah, man, we can't have him. Nah, man, it's not going to work.
That's what happened. Wow.
Like, he went to Tony Dungy, who was kind of like football Yoda and a man that white people trust, and it's largely because of things surrounding his faith, which, for what it's worth, I think it's important to note, gives Tony Dungy some political allegiances that can probably get him into rooms with people that might not let the average black coat Super Bowl or not get into those rooms, right? And so he had the right cosign.
Is there something else? Is there the Christian piece? Is he a Republican?
It's fundamentalist Christian and the things that often come with that, right?
Right, got it.
But he had the guy that was able to do that, and then he came out and balled. Like, I wonder how this goes. If it comes out of jail and just looks like a regular old quarterback, how this works as opposed to coming out of jail in that 2010 year balling.
Yeah. Well, also, I mean, they was in financial trouble, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, you got a situation there, you know. So it was, you know, he had to, you know, be able to handle that. But it definitely complicates. I think like we go past this a lot. I was just watching, you know, I was watching this thing on DeSean, and there's that moment earlier this year where somebody is like questioning DeSean about, you know, some pass or something, and he basically breaks down the entire play.
Right.
And the sheer amount of labor these cats had to do, you know what I mean? Like, the sheer amount of work. And so to come out of prison, to have to get your body right, to have to get your mind right, you know what I mean? To run that offense and to do, I mean, it's tremendous. And we just sort of, like, we just say hard work, they work hard. And then you kind of, like, skip past it. You know what I mean? But I thought that was one of the things, you know, it clarified. I mean, I could have, you know, used actually a little bit more about that. Because I'm interested. I was very, very interested in how you have to be different in order to actually be successful. You know, you're not quite as fast. You're fast, but not quite as fast as you used to be. So you clearly have to know things in a different kind of way than you did. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting them talking about him working with the trainer when he got out of jail, because that's probably the hardest that he ever had to work in his life, right? Like, right. I know what it's like for me when I got to graduate school and I realized for the first time, oh, so you're telling me that the other smart people work hard too? Oh, right. My bad. I thought we were just demonstrating how smart we were and that was enough. And it's like, oh, so now I have right. to work hard. And that almost right. broke me. Vic, I can imagine when he's up there doing them cone drills and everything else coming out of jail and he's like, I'm not fast anymore. Like, I bet that was jarring to immediately try to cope with.
Do you remember how old he was when he came out?
He is my age, so he was 28, 29.
Okay. So just about to, you know, start to dip a little bit, but he hasn't been working out. You know what I mean? He hasn't really been doing what he was, you know, he's working out a little bit, but certainly not at an NFL level.
Eating prison food.
A couple years off.
Ain't no training table at Leavenworth.
No, ain't no training table at Leavenworth. Doing push-ups.
We'll be back in a minute with Ta-Nehisi Coates, but first, hiring is challenging, but there's one place you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. And growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. Codable co-founder Gretchen Huebner experienced how challenging hiring can be after unsuccessfully searching for a new game artist to grow her education tech company. But then she switched to ZipRecruiter and saw an immediate difference, and you can too by signing up for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Bomani. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. And by using ZipRecruiter's screening questions to filter candidates, Gretchen found it easier to focus on the best ones, then find the right one. In fact, after posting her job on ZipRecruiter, Gretchen says she was honestly surprised she found qualified applicants so quickly and hired a new game artist in less than 2 weeks. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/Bomani. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BOMANI.
Do you feel like this generation of black quarterbacks are more conscious and more aware, like, of their relationship to the NFL and that this will not always be a party? I just happened to watch the Deshaun thing before we got on, and he was like, one of the things he said, you know, was he was talking about his financial, you know, stuff and how he really is just a catastrophic injury away. Like, he was clearly aware of that. Mm-hmm. You know,
that's a great question, right? Because I also think we're dealing with some interesting class and race stuff within the black quarterbacks, right? Mm-hmm. So this year, the top 5 offenses in the league all had black quarterbacks. It wasn't the Texans, though. Like he's out of this right. window. But Patrick Mahomes lived a different life than Russell Wilson lived a different life than Lamar Jackson, where Lamar Jackson's life is much different than all these guys, right? And so we get into, like, we both know Sandy Darity. His skin shade research is some of the best stuff that anybody's got going, and people don't realize, like, how much of an effect that has. But, like, Russell Wilson, half of America thinks Russell Wilson has one white parent and kind of treats him as such in that way. Patrick Mahomes.
They think he's biracial. They think Russell Wilson's biracial.
They do. Patrick Mahomes is biracial. Dak Prescott is biracial. And by the way, I have to bring it up with these cats, because with Prescott, for example, in Dallas, people have talked about this, the idea that him being biracial allows him to talk to both sides of the locker room,
He said that.
Yep. Which, by the way, one
thing in the world
is a tacit acknowledgement of the segregation of NFL locker rooms, right?
Yeah.
But two, that's like, these things matter in that way. And I remember seeing an interview with Prescott once, and Prescott was like, yeah, you know, it helps me because, you know, I used to go hang out with my white side of my family, you know, they're teachers and stuff, and I go hang out with the black side of the family, and they sell drugs. And it was like, oh, no. But I could be wrong here, but I feel like a dude who's inclined to say something like that is a dude who probably thinks it's all going to be gravy forever and that, you know, I'm being treated like the other quarterbacks are. But I don't know what's going to happen with any of them.
You know,
if they
slip. Is like my issue with him, with the position he took on, you know, in terms of Kaepernick, where it's like, look, don't ever take an L for the bosses. Don't ever do that. you ain't got to agree with Cap. You ain't got to kneel. You ain't got to do nothing. But don't defend them. Don't ever defend them. You know what I mean? Because they will put you out in a second and think nothing of it. I imagine it can be a little confusing because I think football especially builds a kind of fraternal feeling, you know, especially right. when things are going great. And I don't even mean just between the players. I mean, you know, with the coaches, with the owners, right. you know what I mean? They you know, the owners talk about it. There's a family. They
right.
say things like that. And then when it comes time to, you know, look at the salary cap or look at, you know, whatever, they're very clear about it being a business.
Right.
You know, and I worry, you know what I mean, when I hear something like that, that folks are not as savvy as they should be.
While it's all good, it's all good. But the test is what happens when you slip just a little
right.
bit. You ain't even got to slip
right.
a lot. It's when you
right.
slip just a little bit. And that's what I don't know if these young cats believe. Because also, in part, like, I don't feel like Patrick Mahomes is living with the, for lack of a better term, stigma of being a black quarterback. I don't think Russell Wilson has, in part because he won so much young, but also I think in part because of how he presents, right? Like, he's not being treated like Cam Newton was treated, for example. And they're not being treated like Lamar Jackson was being treated. And Lamar, who I would imagine knows exactly what's going on here.
Right.
I worry about him because if he comes out next year, like Peyton Manning in his third or fourth year was bad, right? This happens with quarterbacks at this point in their
right.
careers. If he comes out
right.
and has a not great season, I am so fearful of what the reaction is going to be because
yeah.
there's so many people who ultimately want to be proven correct, and the only way they can is through his failure. And look, this happened even to Robert Griffin, who has did
right.
more to bend over backwards to please
right.
people in that way
right.
than anybody I remember.
Right, that's a tragedy. That one was a tragedy right there, man. That really, really was a tragedy. I mean, so, like, the question I got to ask, though, is, like, do you feel like if this was 20, 30 years ago, do you think, like, Russell and Patrick Mahomes, do you think they would be under the stigma then?
Probably.
Like, have certain things just shifted because, like, the line has shifted a little bit because
yeah,
of the time?
I think so. Like, I think if you go back, like I say, I don't have the same recollection of what it was for Randall, right? But, I mean,
right.
30 years ago, we're talking about being in that era. Like, I think about the early 90s, how few black quarterbacks even, like, passed through the doors, right, to get a chance to be the dude that we talked about. Like, it took a while. Like, this, if people need to remember, this is, like, the second or third black quarterback renaissance, right? Like, we had one in the late 90s. We had one in the middle of the 2000s. And then we had this one. And what stands out about this one is, I want to say last year, there were 8 starting black quarterbacks overall out of the 32 teams. And with the exception of one or two at Tampa Bay and Indianapolis, everybody else was balling. Like, it spelled out the fact that, oh, we're going to have some black quarterbacks if y'all out here balling. There ain't about to be no version of the black Nick Foles hanging around here being sorry and getting $50 million.
No, that's not happening. There ain't going to be no black Nick Foles. That is not happening.
It's not going down,
that's when
right?
we know it's equal. That's when we'll know it's equal, when there's a black Nick Foles.
Yep, and we're not there, right? Like, that part we're not getting to. But I wondered, like, what you first brought up, like, how aware these cats are. Cause, like, I know myself personally, up until I was about 25, like, you know, I grew up going to school in a small town in Texas with a bunch of white people who I would say overwhelmingly treated me well. Like, I was quite the optimist about these things until Katrina came and I watched the news coverage of Katrina and I was like, oh, okay, my bad. You were right, Dad. I misunderstood. Like,
yeah, but you had conscious parents too. I mean,
yes.
You had a conscious family.
Yeah, but I thought everything was cool. You know, I thought that things were better than they were. And I feel like when you're young and you're successful and everything's breaking your way, even if you don't think the world has changed, you think you so special that the world ain't going to come get you, and they're going to come get them all. At some point, the world is going to get them all. Like Patrick Mahomes, how many touchdowns he got to throw where he could have a bad season and people won't be ready to throw him out? Because I ain't seen a black quarterback do that yet.
Even though he's not getting that stigma right now, it can happen.
Yes.
It can still happen.
It's waiting on you. It's around the corner. No one has ever outperformed racism.
Right.
Duke Ellington
right.
couldn't outperform
right.
racism, right? Nobody's
right.
ever been
right.
so damn good
right.
that it never came up.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I hope they know that.
Yeah. No, I hope so, too. I just hope they're ready. I hope folks are, actually, because there's a lot of celebration right now. You know what I mean? And it is a – and you know, but the thing I would ask you, has something positive changed, though? Like, has
oh,
like,
I do.
Like the presence of these cats in the first place, you
oh,
know
yeah.
what I mean? Which is different.
Oh, yeah. No, no, no.
Yeah.
Things are better. Like, there are 8 black quarterbacks in the NFL, right? And I don't
right,
want to get
right,
to
right.
a point where, like, the Malcolm X,
right.
you pull the knife 6 inches out and call it progress, right?
Yeah,
I don't
yeah,
want
exactly.
to be that guy,
right.
but, yo, man, there are 8 black quarterbacks in the league, and right. Here's what's about to happen. I've talked about this on here before, but this might blow your mind a little bit. In the league right now, there is not an excellent white quarterback who was drafted after 2009. Because Andrew Luck is out of the league now. None of the white quarterbacks who went in the first round of the last decade are really any good. Like, after that, you get to, like...
You're talking about, like, your Trubisky's.
Yep. And you get, like, Derek Carr in the second round. You get, like, Jimmy Garoppolo. Yeah. Like, you get a few guys that come lower. But college ranks are not producing the great white quarterbacks that they did. And they've been selling quarterbacks in this league for so long. Drew Brees, Peyton Manning, Eli Manning, Tom Brady, Ben Roethlisberger, in spite of being Ben Roethlisberger. Like, these white quarterbacks have been the face. It's the reason why we don't call the NFL a black league, but we call the NBA a black league. Because we got these white dudes out front. I don't know what's going to happen here, but now that the spread That's offenses right, have man. Come in, and the reads are simplified, which means that your bias is against black people. If you think, oh, they're too stupid to read a defense. Well, now reading a defense is easier than ever. So your story that you tell doesn't even hold up anymore. Yeah. And you might look up and look around and see this league has 60, 70% black quarterbacks. And I don't know if anybody's fully ready for that.
Yeah, that would change a lot. I mean, that would change. I mean, you try to imagine, like, what the labor relations are, you know, in that situation, being the NFL, what it is, who the ownership actually is, how it's marketed to America. I mean, that. And then I have to add, you know, like, what I would hope would happen. Because I think, and I have to believe this would happen, because it took a while, but it happened. In the NBA, eventually, these cats realized their power. Like, I would say, you know, LeBron's generation, they understood some things, and not because they, you know, maybe necessarily better. I mean, each generation builds on the last, but they understood some things that maybe Barkley and Jordan's generation didn't quite, you know?
Right.
So at that point, will folks start to understand their power? Like, what that actually means, that they can, you know, will they actually be able to make some demands? Will, for instance, a Kaepernick protest that happens in that time, does it go different? You
right.
know?
And how hard would the owners be willing to go? And by the way, shout out to Gabe. He pointed out Carson Wentz. That's probably the best of the white dudes from that decade to come out.
But
that's one. LOL. That is correct. that is simply one. But like, the thing I've always wondered about those protests and things. Yeah, are you familiar with the story about the dudes at the University of Wyoming in the late '60s, early '70s?
Vaguely, but go through it. Vaguely.
Yeah.
They got thrown off campus, didn't they?
Yeah. So basically, they wanted to do a protest before the game against BYU because BYU would not allow black people to be clergy. You know, in the LDS church, not BYU, but the LDS church would not allow black men to be clergy. And so they went to the coach to talk about a protest, and he kicked all of them off the team just for walking in the door to talk about it, right? Like, they didn't come on the field. They didn't even get the chance to embarrass them in front of nobody. They just brought it up, right? And they tossed them all off. And so on one level, I think we look at this and say, yo, if these cats flex their power, they can't throw all of us out of here. But that's kind of like feeling like if I park illegally and it's everybody else doing it, they can't tow all our cars. Yes, they can. All the trucks will be out.
What happened to them cats?
They went to other programs, and then recently Wyoming has tried to do some measure of reconciliation, but they won't go so far as to apologize. And, you know, Wyoming's one of them schools that was taking black dudes, because how else were y'all going to be any good at football? Y'all in Wyoming, right? And so they're like, yeah, like all those off-the-beaten-path places, they always were about that diversity. Yeah, come on over here to the middle of nowhere, you know?
Right.
Show up.
Right.
We got you. And so I wonder, like, how hard is the power structure willing to go on some of these matters to where they put everybody out? Because it feels like you can't do that and the money is too strong. But we don't see people set money on fire forever in the name of racism.
Oh, yeah. In a second. I mean, I would argue that there's probably some financial incentive for bringing Kaepernick back, actually, long term. You know what I mean? Like, I would argue, like, there's something in that. You could make some sort of financial case for that. Well, maybe it'd be hard this year, but you know what I mean? 2 years down the road, da 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 da. You know what I mean? Like, you
right.
certainly could make that case, especially for some of these teams that really needed a quarterback. You know? And if anything, Vic shows how quickly white people forget things when folks start winning.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like how, like football, even in that case, even as much as they love their dogs, once Vic got there and started winning, you know, suddenly you ain't hear too much about dogs no more.
Nope. That was the study, because I was stunned when they signed him that people were still so mad, because I thought they had gotten over it. And then I remember Kevin Cobb started that one game. He got hurt. Vic came in, and you could tell what Andy Reid had always wanted to do. He was like, good enough for me. New starter.
Yeah.
That guy right there. That guy. He's like, you crazy? You think I sent Donovan McNabb packing for Kevin Cobb? What are you, high?
Right.
That guy right there. Right. Come on over. Right. And you're right. Everything was cool. Because then they were winning. And that's what I always said about Kaepernick, is people compartmentalize in a very interesting way, that if Colin wound up on a team and was able to make a little something happen, all this would be out the window.
It'd go out the window. If he had been on the Titans this year, for instance,
woo!
You know what I mean?
If he'd been on the 49ers, the team used to play for, they would have won the Super Bowl.
Yeah. It'd be a very, very, very different conversation. It'd be a very, very different conversation. And perhaps folks know that. You know what I mean?
I tell you this too, though. If he had been on a team that won the Super Bowl, Disney World is not asking him to say he's on the way. Right?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Can you imagine Colin on that float with a black leather jacket and a fist up, riding down past the Magic Kingdom?
Nah, it's crazy. It's crazy. It's a very, very interesting time, man, to be watching these dudes and to, you know, be dealing with the ethical issue of whether I should be watching in the first place, you know what I mean, and what that means and what we're supporting. And yet, you know what I mean, this feels like a really, really revolutionary, you know, moment for the sport, given the centrality of football, of pro football, to American life. You know, did we have 3-4 black quarterbacks in the playoffs?
We had a shot at an all-black Super Bowl for a while there. I think we had 6. Either way, it was very high, and I was afraid that it was going to take out, like, the Democratic primary. Like, next thing you know.
Right. Like, we're all going to take each other out.
Yeah, next thing you know, you look up. It is Ryan Tannehill and Jimmy Garoppolo.
Right.
Staring down a Super Bowl. it is big, and to me, you are from Baltimore, and I was just, like, I wondered this. Like, if you were a kid in Baltimore right now and Lamar Jackson emerges, is there any other star in your orbit?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely. I mean, the O's done sucked for forever since I was in high school. We had a brief period in the 90s, I guess. Absolutely not. I mean, it is an incredible, incredible thing. And especially for a town, you know what I mean, where the Colts haven't left and avoid that laugh. And then it's wild how the Ravens leave. How they leave Cleveland. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Browns leave Cleveland, come to Ravens, immediately become a winning franchise. It's horrible.
I hadn't thought about that in those terms.
It's horrible. It's like horrible. I think maybe, like, it got to be within 5 years of leaving Cleveland. They got, you know, Ray Lewis, Jonathan Ogden. You know
I mean? Immediately after they left, they drafted those two dudes. Ozzie drafted them the first draft in Baltimore. Two Hall of Famers, first round.
Boy,
that's gotta hurt.
That's cruel. That's cruel.
I hadn't thought about that. I really had not thought about that. But I just remember, like, when I saw Lamar, and look, somebody along the way made the decision where we watch Cam, and I don't knock Cam for this. In fact, I probably would encourage some of this the same. We watch people, you know. Hey, Cam, you're going to need a little more polish, right? Like, if you're going to be the front of this franchise in this way, right? Yeah. You know, and all of us get a little more polish as we go along the way, no matter who you are. Like, I don't think that idea is necessarily that offensive. But with Lamar, they may be telling him to get some polish on him, but they're like, take your time. Because there's
– Nah. And I love him for that.
Yep.
I speak how I speak. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Like I respect it. Like, in some ways, I'm like, you're public. You could probably improve, right? Even if you speak how you speak, because it's new to you. Yeah. But no, the Ravens have been like, nah, whatever. You got it.
Yeah.
Go on up here.
Yeah. We understand what he said.
Yep. And that's always my point, by the way. If you understood what I was talking about, why are we tripping?
Yeah, what are we doing? What are we doing? Nah, they understood what he said. You know what I mean? You know, as long as I can understand him when he called him audibles, is okay. We're good.
Then that comes the other end where I'm like, it's all good while it's all good. Now, to be fair,
That's true.
But that polish wouldn't save him if it was going bad anyway. Dak Prescott out here and start stinking.
Yeah.
Ain't nobody going to be but his verbs.
It ain't going to matter. But, you know, and a large part of that is, like, people just associating how you talk with intelligence.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Which is, you know, always, you know, and forever incorrect and wrong. And nobody, you know, anybody should know more about this than Southern white folks. You know what I mean?
Yes.
But, of course, that's kind of normalized in a way that, you know, our stuff is not. So.
Yeah, but I also wondered, like, part of that,
has to be endearing to people of Baltimore because everybody trying to trip on how y'all talk. And I'm not even being funny, like,
oh,
for
yeah.
real.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There's a video out there with, like, an accent. A dude doing a Baltimore accent. I can't remember what the sentence, but they make him say a sentence. And they try to get him, I guess, to pronounce it the way it's supposed to be pronounced. I showed it to my wife. My wife's like, what did he say? I was like, I understood exactly what he said. It's like, Earn. Earn did something with an iron. Earn did something. I'm going to say it. Earn earned an iron earned. Which is, I guess, in America, is Aaron earned an iron urn.
Yo, I didn't know that there was a Baltimore accent until I got to college. And I was like,
I didn't know there was a Baltimore accent until I got to college.
Oh, you had to find out that the rest of us didn't talk like that.
Oh, man. They was like, yo, what did you say? What'd you just say? Oh, man. Nah, I didn't know. I didn't know. But nah. You know, we're kind of used to that. You know what I mean? And the other thing is, it's like, there's a white Baltimore accent that ain't the black Baltimore accent. You know what I mean? Like, you couldn't do that sentence with a white dude from Baltimore. They got their own accent, which is actually different, you know?
Well, like, I got to college, my roommate was from Philly, and that is a whole world. Like, Philly is like Oakland East. Y'all don't use any words that anybody else uses. Like, your slang does not travel across city lines, state lines, anywhere else. Y'all are the only people who talk like this. I'm like a bull. I'm from, you know, I grew up in Texas. I'm like, bulls? Oh, y'all call each other bulls. Okay. Gotcha. I guess I get it.
Yeah, this John here, this John.
I was like, what is this? I have no idea. Like, getting to college for me was just a whole lot of, like, I listened to a lot of rap. I thought I knew how people talked. I did not.
Yeah.
I totally misunderstood.
Nah, not at all.
Hey, man. So, man, what else you got going these days, man?
Trying to figure that out, man. I published, like, that novel came out, my novel, Water Dancer, came out, you know, last year. You know, we're lucky to do, you know, reasonably well. And trying to figure it out, just trying to figure it out, man. It's like, you know, having been at the Atlantic for all those years, it was like, it was always clear, you know, what was next. And now it's, you know, it's not always, you know, so obvious.
So now you're looking for something else hard as hell for you to do.
I am. Yeah, no, that's true. That's exactly it. I mean, I will always, you know, continue to write books. That's definitely going to happen. I would just really enjoy that practice. But, you know, it's like every time you do a different, you know, book, it really is a different book, you know, and you got to figure out how to write it. And, you know, I really, really enjoy that. So, you know, probably look at something, you know, in that range.
One of the most admirable things about you, and I thought about it with all this Kobe stuff, was that Kobe had this outright lack of fear of failure. Like, I used to clown Kobe for the idea that he was trying to rap, but I read this story that was like, Kobe would battle anybody. Kobe was battling dudes in hotel lobbies just for saying that he could not rap, and he just didn't care if it didn't go well. Like, you are always looking for something else that provides the challenge rather than staying as something that you've demonstrated that you can do, and that's just wildly impressive to me.
Yeah, no, man, I think it has to do with where your self-esteem is, though. Like, my self-esteem, for the most part, is, I mean, this goes back to where we started this conversation with, like, when do you get on? And if you get on in your 30s, a lot of times you have to build yourself up as a person and an identity separate from what your career is or what your vocation is, because maybe that's not going so well. It wasn't going, I mean, look, I was on unemployment when I was 32, you know what I'm saying? So I had to develop, you know, some sort of sense of who I was in other places. And believe it or not, while my writing is really, really, really important to me, it's probably not at the core. You know what I mean? It's probably, you know, probably my kid is at the core, my wife's at the core, my mom and dad, my brothers and sisters, you know, my friends. Like, that is, you know, like, when you want unemployment, you better have other qualities that people around you value you for.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, hey, I'm a good friend. You know what I mean? You know, I'm that. You know what I mean? Like, you have to figure out other things. You know what I mean? People value good friends. They actually do. People value good family members. You know what I mean? Who are solid and that sort of thing. And so when all this other stuff started happening, it was like, you know, like, what is going on here? You know, so it's like, I if it goes bad, it goes bad. I don't want it to go bad. You know, but the thrill of trying, you know, something new. The thrill of, for instance, you know, trying to make this shift over to fiction, you know, was significant. And in many ways, you know, and I think you'll get this, it's like, you're always just trying to tell a story. That part, you know what I mean, never leaves it, you know. But the thing I got to ask you is, was Kobe any good?
Yo.
Like, as a rapper, was he any good?
He wasn't bad. That would probably be the best way to put it. But you know what's wild? I'm evaluating that according to what the game was in, like, 1996. I feel like if I go back and listen to some of that stuff now, I might be like, yo, Kobe had bars. You know, because like what it means to have bars now is a completely like different concept or idea, you know. And somebody, my man Miles Brown, always makes this point. The biggest problem for Kobe on that front was the presence of Allen Iverson. Like he looks like what the rap guy is supposed to be. Kobe out here trying to rap in Italian. Yo, what's up with that?
Listen to Iverson's joint. Like, I never listened to Juice. Was he any good? Was Iverson any good?
He was not bad, but I do remember this.
Okay.
In 2000, I did an interview with Talib Kweli, and he made the best point about why the 40 bars and everything made people so uncomfortable. It was like, he was the first dude that wanted to rap and be taken seriously, like, by rappers. Like, this wasn't Shaq, like, hey, I got a chance to make some records with my favorite people. Allen Iverson viewed himself, like, as an MC, you know, and this is what MCs do. And they were like, whoa, ho, ho, wait a minute there, buddy.
Yeah.
You know? But also, here's what I imagine about Iverson, too. If he was good, thank goodness, like, he must have really wanted to be good. Because can you imagine what it would be like to be Allen Iverson's partner and he plays you your music, especially knowing who those dudes were? They said everything was dope. Yo, man, that was what was up. Yeah, that's all right.
That's what they there for.
Yep.
what they there for.
It's hard to tell your friends that their music is whack, though. We all been there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, keep trying. Keep at it. That's a good start. Yeah. Man, Ta-Nehisi Coates, check out The Water Dancer wherever you get books. Man, thank you so much, man. I really appreciate the time.
Thanks for having me on, brother.
Oh, man, this is fantastic, man. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassain handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Thank you to Ta-Nehisi Coates. Thank you to our sponsors, ZipRecruiter, 5-Hour Energy, My Computer Career. All right, remember, subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to think you are hater. We'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.
The Right Time with Bomani Jones is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.